Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Cop shows. They've enamored us with forensic work, not just the CSIs, but forensic psychologists. But what's it really like to be one? Karen Franklin is a forensic psychologist. She's also adjunct professor at Alliant University. She conducts ethics trainings for clinical professionals, forensic professionals. I guess that means for other psychologists and lawyers and investigators and detectives and those kind of dudes and dudettes. And she has written on hate crime motivations. What are the real motivations? Not so simple. Group rape, interesting topic. And ethics, I love that topic, in forensic diagnosis. Karen Franklin, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you, Marty. It's so great to be here. I appreciate your inviting me.
You're welcome. You know, as I was reading the introduction, and I found myself stuck on something I wasn't thinking about asking you. You developed an interest in group rape. Where'd that come from?
That came because I do a lot of work with sex offenders, sex offender evaluations for the courts, and I realized that the motivations were different in gang or group rape than in individual rape most of the time. And I had done this earlier research on the motivations of anti-gay hate crime perpetrators, and it dawned on me that the motivations are almost the same for those two classes of crimes that most people think of as very different.
Now, let me guess. I'm thinking that, especially in the case of the group rapes, that they would break down into a couple of categories. There's the power play thing. There is the people who are simply, you know, so stoned or drunk or whatever that lowers inhibitions. And then there are some that really is about sex and the thrill of the conquest. I know nothing about that field. To what extent is that accurate or inaccurate?
That's pretty good, Marty. That really is. What my thesis is in terms of writing about this and thinking about it is that both types of crimes are dramas. And they're put on like a stage production with an audience in mind. And so the person is performing masculinity. So either the target being like a gay man, that would be performing heterosexual masculinity. And if the object is a woman being raped by a group of men, they are performing their masculinity for each other.
Is there a countervailing opinion that has a lot of credibility in that space, or is that pretty much hegemonic?
I think I might be one of the only people who's ever looked at it this way, and I don't think that anybody would really argue with it, though, if they thought about it.
Let me try for the fun of it to think of what could be an alternative hypothesis. I think and I may be overgeneralizing, but I think the kind of people who would do something as heinous as group rape are not even semi-consciously aware of this concept of traditional masculinity or whatever, but it's more in the same way as group hysteria. What happens is people, there's this group, they get whipped up in a frenzy almost in the same way as fans at a baseball game. They just get, you know, if you watch at home, you're rarely going to be screaming at the television set. But if you're there together, you go a hoop and you holler. So I'm wondering, apart from any kind of gendered or race X or sexual orientation explanation, whether at the core there is this group phenomenon, especially under the influence of substances. What do you think about that hypothesis?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is a part of it. There's a group dynamic that sets in, and then I've interviewed people who have committed these types of crimes, and they actually say that they did not intend for things to go as far as they did, and they didn't know that they were going to go as far. But once the event starts to unfold, they feel just caught up. And especially, like you said, when there's alcohol or other drugs involved, it really there is a group dynamic it's very, very powerful.
And it's even more likely to be powerful. See, in sports, it's one thing, but then when you add the sexual sex drive on top of it. So, you know, even forgetting about a group, a single person, you know, I think about myself when I was younger. There was a point at which I was so eager to have this woman. It is not a power play. It had nothing to do with anything. I was turned on. I really wanted her, and that would get me to be a little more aggressive than I would otherwise be, simply because of the testosterone coursing through my veins. So when you're talking about a group rape situation, you not only have the drugs, you not only have the group incessant thing, turning it, accelerating the drive, but you now have the sexual thing on top of it. Is that fair?
To some extent, yes, but the interesting thing with the group dynamic is that there's more of a performance anxiety. At least this is how a lot of men experience it. They're not really so turned on as they are afraid of not being turned on.
Now, there's a surprise, and I like to hear that. That's great. Okay, but now we've got ahead of it. My curiosity got the best of it.
Right.
But let's go back to you and how, you know, nobody ever grew up as a little girl saying, Mommy, when I grow up, I want to be a forensic psychologist. So if I recall correctly, you were really an investigative journalist initially, and then you had an experience there that made you decide that you wanted to be a forensic psychologist. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, actually, as a kid, I wanted to be an archaeologist.
Oh, okay.
That's not very realistic, I guess. But yeah, and it wasn't so linear, like I was an investigative journalist and then I just had an experience. I actually had left journalism by that time. I was a legal affairs journalist for some years, working covering the courts. Then I became a criminal investigator, and I worked for a public defender's office. And it was in that capacity, I was working on a unit specializing in death penalty cases. And that's where I met forensic psychologists up close and personal for the first time. And I realized, wow, you know, this is a job that has a lot of power to explain things in a way that neither journalists nor criminal investigators. There's kind of a trend, right? Sort of a curiosity and seeking
and storytelling.
Answers and storytelling. Yes, but journalists and investigators are more just gathering facts and telling things more on a superficial level, and the psychologists can go really deep and explain things that might seem very inexplicable on the surface.
Now, of course, that takes us to the whole realm of certitude and lack therein. You know, one can create a thread that becomes a coherent story, but there, each one of those, let's change the metaphor to links in a chain. Each of those links in a chain, have variable strength. Some could be rock solid. Others could be really quite conjectural. How solid are the stories and the testimony in general that a forensic psychologist gives? How certain are you, and what goes through your head and your heart as you're preparing a case, as you're making the case on the stand?
I think, well, that's a good question. I think it really depends. It depends on the type of case. It depends what I'm testifying to. There are certain times that I'm feeling very confident and very solid about what I'm saying, and there's other times, like when we're being asked to predict the future, where I can't be certain.
Right.
I can only I can only talk in terms of likelihoods and probabilities rather than certitudes. And in fact, part of my job, as I see it in those cases, is to try to tamp down the expectations of judges and juries
to be more realistic. Right. Oh, good. Let's take a case.
Okay.
So take a case that's meaty and interesting that you've had, and let's walk us through it, the things that, you know, and let's end up with a case where it ends up being ambiguous what your thoughts are. But walk me through the moment you're assigned a case or you got the case, and walk me through the various interesting, let's call them inflection points, changes, exciting things, whatever. Walk me through a case.
What's one thing that's interesting about forensic psychology is that people think of us as working at the front end of cases, mostly like trials. A person is arrested for a crime, and then we work up the case along with the attorneys and then testify. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the work that I do is way down the road after that point in time, when the person has already either been found guilty or pled guilty and maybe served a lot of time. And the question is, are they ready for release yet? This is a really complex area because you are having to some extent, forecast the future.
Yes. Are you neutral, or are you more of a mitigate? You know, I had a social worker on, and her job was to testify to basically mitigate sentences. Others, you know, have a bias toward keeping him in prison. Are you a neutral, or do you have a de facto or de jure perspective on the issue?
I try to come in completely neutral and open-minded, and one way that I do that is I try, instead of forming an opinion right off the bat, mm-hmm, I try mm-hmm. to be a little bit more scientific and develop competing hypotheses.
Exactly.
Like one hypothesis Great. Would be that this person is low risk. Mm-hmm. Another would be that this
Good.
Person is high risk. And then I try to line up the facts and the evidence and see which solution is more parsimonious. And that's where the, like you said, it's not certain because reasonable people could differ
yeah.
on that.
I would so wish that journalists would do that. Instead of going in with their... Now, some journalists are really, they respect the sacred obligation of presenting all well-founded, well-thought-out views across the ideological spectrum. But usually they go, many have a tendency to come in with an a priori bias. But if one were to look back, if I were, for example, let's say I was an attorney and I was evaluating you, I'm representing a... let's say I'm representing somebody who has spent 10 years in prison for armed robbery, and I'm evaluating you based on your track record, would I be perceiving you as more likely to be a mitigation person, in other words, encouraging the person to get him out early, or you be a tough person and more likely to keep him or her in prison?
Well, if you were evaluating me as an attorney, you would have one opinion, and I'll tell you what that is. But if you were me... I see it a little bit differently. So an attorney is only going to see what's on the public surface of
right.
what I've done. And
right.
they're going to – I do a lot of work for the courts,
mm-hmm.
and that's very, very neutral.
Mm-hmm.
I can just call it as it is, and my I write a report, and it's taken into consideration by the courts. But I'm more likely to be hired by the defense. So mm-hmm. so an attorney might think that I have that mm-hmm. bias mm-hmm. toward mm-hmm. – helping with mitigation, but what they don't see, because it's behind the scenes and undercover, is that I don't take somewhere between 7 to 9 out of 10 cases.
Wow.
So up to 90% of cases where a defense attorney might come to me and say, hey, can you help me with this evaluation and potentially testify in this case,
hmm.
I look at the case initially and I turn them down.
You said the courts are neutral. I actually found it surprising. You know, think about all of the furor that's gone on around Judge Gorsuch. You know,
yeah.
No one would say that there are people have a neutral, blind scales of justice. That, there's very strong opinions. Are really courts very neutral, or are there? You know, I always think of certain. You know, courts is likely being much more, throw the book at them, and others that are much more mitigation oriented.
You're talking about judges?
Judges. I'm assuming the judge in courts that the fish smells from the top. That the judge's perspective lends goes down the pike because he ends up or she ends up choosing people beneath who are sharing similar ideological biases. What do you think?
Well, certainly that's the case with the. Public perception of the Supreme Court and Gorsuch in particular as him being an ideologue. But in the local courts and the regular courts and even the federal courts, I think judges have gotten there because they were good at their jobs and ethical for the most part.
They're elected.
And I think
so many are elected though, right?
Some are elected. A lot are appointed. But they, I think for the most part, they take their job very, very seriously and they try to apply the law as accurately as possible. And in fact, one of their big fears is being overturned on appeal for doing something wrong. So a lot of their motivation is to do things by the book. And in some ways, they're handcuffed by laws. For example, there are cases that I've been involved in where a person maybe committed a crime that doesn't merit a lengthy sentence, but they have to impose mm-hmm. a lengthy sentence because that's what the legislature or the public has said they had to do, and they're frustrated on that end.
You know, if anything, again, as a non-lawyer, I would think that it is not easy to become nominated as a circuit judge or a Supreme Court judge. That if anything, there would be a greater prioritization of really fair-mindedly looking at cases at those higher levels. Rather than the lower, yet even at that the pinnacle court of the land, no one would say that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is neutral or that any of them are. They all are very clearly. There are very few moderates left. Everybody's on the left and on the right. So is it really true that why would it be that you're saying at the lower level courts they're actually less biased?
The way my experience with the court system is that in general, they're trying to be fair and trying to be reasonable and within the constraints of the system that they're operating under.
I want to go back to the case in a minute, but I want to let our listeners know you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking with Karen Franklin. She is a forensic psychologist located actually right here in El Cerrito. So you got the, you know, she's local. Let's go back to that case. So you've got a perpetrator who is in for 10 years for his third armed robbery. And now you are trying to present the best cases you can on the positive and negative side of whether you think his probability of recidivism. Tell me something interesting about what your work would be at that point or later, you know, as you got on the stand or whatever.
Right. Well, let me get a little bit more into a specific case. It's not three armed robberies, but I'm thinking of a case that's kind of a good example, and it's one that I think I'm a little bit proud of just because justice prevailed. It's not me that causes justice prevail. It's a team effort. But in this particular case, a young man who was 18 years old committed an assault. It wasn't a particularly severe assault in terms of injury to the victim. It was somebody he knew, and he punched this person, and they fell down and had some minor bruises and scrapes, but nothing that even required hospitalization.
Okay.
For whatever reason, he ended up in a state psychiatric hospital as insane instead of being criminally prosecuted.
How did that happen to be?
There was, from what I understand, and I came into the case 12 years down the road.
Oh, 12 years?
Yeah, 12 years.
The case was alive for 12 years?
Yeah.
How unusual is that?
It's not that unusual.
Jesus.
And this is something people don't understand about insanity.
Oh, my God.
People think, oh, this person is getting found not guilty by reason of insanity or using the insanity acquittal, right? And the words not guilty or acquittal sounds like they get away with something. In reality, they can get caught up in the state psychiatric system, and it's very, very hard to get out.
12 years is not uncommon.
Right.
Okay, walk me through what happened.
So, yeah, the system's kind of set up to keep people. It's very risk-averse, right? So there's an assumption of danger. So this young man, he was 18 when this happened, and then 12 years later, I'm called in by his defense attorney, and I evaluate him, and I don't find any evidence of current mental disorder whatsoever.
Wow.
So the hospital was claiming that he had some personality disorders that made him dangerous, and I didn't agree with that. So,
by the way, before you go, this is great. I want to keep it on, but, you know, how important is if let's say I know somebody who has schizophrenia. He's a family member, and I know he can also put on a great act. How possible is it for somebody who could actually be dangerous, you know, whether it be a psychopathic, but I just saw No Country for Old Men recently, that's true. I know you don't like the term psychopathic or even psychopathy, but this guy was truly a psych. You know, how well can people malinger?
Great question, and this is one of the big issues that we always have to answer in every single case. We have to look at malingering. But what's very cool and fortunate in these types of cases is we have massive records, and especially if somebody's been in the state psychiatric hospital for 12 years, they're watching his every move. He's like a bug under a microscope.
Yes,
you've got thousands of pages of documentation of what his every move is. So if he's violent, you know, if he's a liar,
if
he's anything like that. And then plus another thing I do, because you're right, people can try to fake you out.
Absolutely.
And there are ways that we have for detecting that fairly reliably.
Tell me
just to let you know, though, that one of the methods, well, we have tests, but one of the bigger methods that I think it works really well is collateral interviews. So we talk to other people that might know this person.
Of
so
course.
Like in that
yes.
guy's case, I talked to his mother, I talked to his siblings, I spoke with his psychologist that was the main one treating him in the hospital, who also thought there was nothing wrong with him and was wanting him to get out. But she was facing the power of the institution as well, you know. So I think that's looking at the records, interviewing other people that are in a position to know, those are some ways to get around this problem.
Great. So you concluded this person had a low probability of recidivism or you should get out.
Yes.
Then what did you do? Then what happened?
Well, this is another point that might surprise some people about forensic psychology, is that a lot of our work in some of my best work, I think, never sees the light of day in a courtroom.
Tell me more.
Okay. So I'd say that I probably testify in under 10% of the cases that I'm involved in. And instead, most of the time that I spend in a case, it's reading and writing. You know, it's a little bit less glamorous, but it's far more influential and important. And so, for example, in this case, I evaluated this guy. I spoke with these other people, as I mentioned, and I read a lot of documents, and then I just wrote a report. And the report was given to the judge and given to the other side, and they decided just to release him.
Sounds great. Okay, let's turn.
And by the way, I just want to say postscript. He's doing really super well.
Oh, outside. I had a
funny. Yeah, this is like 5 years ago, and he's doing really well. He got a job, went on for higher education, got married, has kids. It's amazing. He's a success story.
Yeah, I knew when you said it was. I jumped from the when you said it was a success story. I knew he was not going to be somebody who then committed an axe murder the next week.
I hope not.
That's
not good.
Story.
Yeah, not a success story.
No, you know, I've actually in our little email exchange right before the show, I coincidentally came upon some article, I don't know if it was on brain scans, or something very physiological in terms of predicting, either ascertaining mental competence to commit a crime and or likely recidivism. What are your thoughts about those physiological brain scans, PET scans and the like?
Yeah, fMRI is one
yeah,
of
exactly.
the main
functional
ones.
Yeah, exactly, functional MRIs, right.
My opinion is that they're not ready for prime time. I think that there's a lot of hype around science in our culture these days, and I think that, you know, the crime shows on TV really play into that, the public being enamored with that, with all, you know, mm-hmm. bright lights and colors and things moving around in the brain.
Right.
And it looks really good, but in terms of the actual science and the reliability of those techniques and the validity of those techniques, I mean, maybe they're on the right path, but they're definitely not at the level yet, I don't think, of being able to say much about the individual based on that kind of aggregate data. And I mean, because, you know, they can come into court and say, oh, look, this person's brain has got this little problem right here, and you can see it right on the screen, and how exciting. But they're not telling you how many other people in the population have that exact same
right.
false issue
positives,
and are
right.
fine, you
right.
know? So
false positives, yes.
Exactly.
Predictive, it all comes down to a phrase I used in one of my emails to you, which is explained variance. How much of a person's, you know, if we looked at 100 people who committed a murder, would have this anomaly, and how many people in a population of people who didn't commit the murder would have that anomaly.
Exactly, and we don't know the answer to that. So I think it's really premature to be...
How could that be? How could they not do... I mean, that would seem like the very most basic study. You know, if I'm a researcher, I'm an fMRI researcher, I'm going to find 100... It's easy to find them because they're clearly identified. These are people convicted of murder. And I'm going to go, and their rights are fairly restricted. I may be able to get an extra treat or whatever if they'll let me do an fMRI on them, which is painless and low risk. So I'm going to go to 100 people who are in San Quentin for murder, and I will do their fMRIs of their frontal cortex, and then I will, or even the whole brain, and then I will take 100 people who are college students at random and to pay them $50 to do it, and I will have an instant publicity. I mean, these imaging techniques have been around for 20 years now. Why is that not around?
Even if one could do that, it wouldn't answer the question of what the role of that brain damage in the behavior is, because it could be just, you know, the phrase correlation, not causation. It could be that, yes, this person may have some brain damage, but no, that doesn't prove anything, really.
Yeah, but, even if you use the beyond the reasonable doubt standard, if you have, you know, if there is studies that show that out of 100 convicted murderers, 50 have this anomaly in the brain, and one or two in a control group, that's going to be a pretty, not dispositive piece of evidence, but it'll be pretty damn strong. Am I wrong?
Could be, but we don't have that.
We don't?
We don't,
okay.
We don't have that.
I'll let that go. Great. Okay, then let's go to the other side of the spectrum, which is the storytelling thing. Now, you say you're playing, are you actually writing a book on storytelling?
Oh, I would like to, but, you know, in my spare time, I never seem to get around to doing these big writing projects that I have in the deeper part of my brain.
I've written 8 books. So what I tell people to do when they think about writing a book, and of course it's daunting, but for a number of reasons, I recommend you write a short powerful 1,000-word article with your main points in it. Why? That number one, you say, you know, this doesn't justify a book. I can say everything I need in 1,000 words. Or it crystallizes your thinking into its essential points and creates a table of contents for a book. What if have you done that already? Have you written an article like that?
I've got a few articles because, you know, I blog. Uh-huh. So I have, and that's what people tell me. Well, it'd be so easy for you to write the book. You just kind of compile all these blog posts that are on the topics.
Yeah, okay.
So I've done some blogging and essays, and then I do have a table of contents or two, you know.
Okay.
So I'm kind of on the path, but I'm really just super jammed and busy these
co-author,
days.
Co-author, what if you had a graduate student in a forensic psychology program say, isn't it John Jay that has a big one in New York?
They have a criminology program,
right.
Really big one.
So I'd find somebody at a prestigious program, a really smart person, and I'd interview some people who you could chemically get along with, because that's co-authorship is an extremely chemical process. And find a co-author. You'd be the kind of, they would do the research, they would do, you know, put it together, and you would be supervisorial chapter by chapter, and that person would get senior authorship with you, which would launch their career, and they'd make a few, you'd agree on a royalty split, so that they'd even get some money from it. What do you think?
Cool idea.
I hadn't thought
of that.
Aim to please. Okay, let's turn to ethics. We're almost out of time, but we're doing great. Ethics. What's a nice, meaty, ethical issue that a forensic psychologist, or no, that you, let's not be abstract,
okay,
that you have faced in your life that wasn't slam dunk. It was gray area is fun.
There's so many ethics issues. I guess one that's really difficult is when you have an initial opinion that you have shared with the parties, and then you change your mind.
Right,
and
right,
especially
right.
If it's late in the course of the game. And I actually had a case where I was on the witness stand.
Well,
actually,
you changed your
on
mind
the witness
stand.
I changed my mind. It was really, it was really a drag because I had to based on new facts that were presenting to me.
Doesn't that make it easy, number one, because you change your mind and you know you're going to get brownie points for showing the wisdom and the strength of character to say, you know what? I was wrong. Isn't that easy?
I'm not really saying I'm wrong. I'm saying, hey, if I had known this other fact, my opinion would have been different. And I did not know that fact. In fact, this was a time when a defense attorney tried to hide a fact from me, and it came out under cross-examination. And I said, whoa, with that fact in mind that I did not know, and I'm sort of shooting daggers at the defense attorney across the room because I'm so upset with this withholding of really important information.
Sure, of course.
There's no way my opinion would stay the same. So that's it's an ethical issue because there is a pull to kind of affiliate once you've gotten to that point and to help the attorney win the case. The attorney is the advocate. I'm not the advocate. I'm just giving my opinion.
Now, I got to tell you, the career of forensic psychologist sounds really fun. I know it's a simplistic word, but as I listen to all this, it's one of the, I've done this segment called What's It Really Like to Be or whatever with dozens of people. I've never found myself saying, oh, I think I might like to do that myself.
Yeah, you would like it. You would be a natural. It is really fun. I mean, I have a very low tolerance for boredom, and I think that's why I've ended up here because there's so many different niches. You never get bored.
What are niches? What are some niches?
Well, I mean, I do so many different types of work. I mean, not only just different types of forensic evaluation. And plus, there's criminal, there's civil, there's child custody. But then I can do teaching and training, and they're just endless possibilities. If you got bored with one thing, you'd just move on and do something else.
Why would anybody then, I'm now biased toward you and the profession. Why would anybody, do people, if I filled this room with 100 people who are forensic psychologists, who are, let's say, over 40, who've been doing it at least 10 years, how many will have left or wanted to leave the profession? I can't imagine many would.
Not a lot. Not like attorneys who often flee
right.
that
Oh,
field.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
But a few do, and I think, it is possible to burn out. And I don't know if you've heard of vicarious traumatization.
Oh, I can imagine. I understand self-evident what it means.
Yeah. There is that at times.
Well, for a lot of our listeners, you know, I would imagine, I'm guessing that is, you know, when you, especially if you're doing work with children and you're seeing children abused, you end up feeling it yourself and it becomes very depressing. Is that the notion?
That's exactly it. You define it without even having heard of it before. That's mm-hmm. pretty good. Yeah, it's basically you're the sponge that's soaking up all this
right.
horrible stuff. And sometimes you're like having to look at graphic photos and videos and it can be overwhelming and people at times just get, it's too much.
You don't seem burned out at all. Am I right? Or tell me the truth.
No, I'm not. I'm not burned out. I'm still very, very into my work. Yeah.
I can feel it. So, is there anything you want? I mean, do you want to say anything as a last? You have choices. You got last thing you can say. You could either say what kind of clients you'd like to hear from, or something that you want to tell our audience that you don't want to feel, oh, damn it, I wish I would have said that on the radio. What do you want? Or you could do both. I'm a generous host here. Yeah. What do you want to say?
That.
What kind of clients? Well, let's take it one at a time. What's one thing you haven't said yet that you think it's important for our listeners to know about being a forensic psychologist?
Well, I think just the fact that we don't have any crystal balls.
Right,
I think people
know.
Expect, like, psychologists in general to be able to, like, read minds or something, which we can't, obviously. And also, you know, our tests are flawed, and nobody, not even a weather forecaster in this day and age with computers as good as they are, can, with 100% certitude, predict the weather. And so we don't have any crystal balls or magic powers. It's just a matter of, like, hard work and doing our best to come up with parsimonious answers.
Alas, Karen Franklin, that's true in every social science field. It's true of sociology explanations for societal phenomena. It's true for educators in the latest magic pill du jour and in all elements of psychology. It's just the human condition. We are at the metaphorical equivalent of alchemy in a world in which maybe 50 years from now we'll be in a world of chemistry.
Yep, I agree 100%.
And now with the last question, is there a particular kind of client that you would particularly like to get or something you want to say? Like, I'm asking you to flog your practice here, your consulting practice.
Oh, that's nice of you.
Yes.
how sweet. So because I told you I'd turned down so many cases, but the ones I'm taking right now, I'm kind of cherry picking because I do have a lot of work coming in, and I'm picking the ones where I feel like I can contribute to justice. So if there's been an injustice and a wrong has been committed and I can help help make that right, that's the kind of case I really enjoy working on.
Everybody has a niche. I mean, you have special expertise in group rape. Is that the core niche where you're almost quintessentially qualified over other forensics? Because everybody wants to do justice. Is there a particular kind of case where you're really the go-to gal?
I think on serious crimes in which the crime is out of character for the individual, I'm a good person because I can – well, we talked about storytelling. I can take that narrative and go back in time and try to clarify what happened, what led up to it, what caused this to happen in a way that humanizes the person and explains conduct that might seem inexplicable on the surface.
Well, you've certainly humanized the profession of forensic psychology. Thank you so much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemko, Karen Franklin.
Thank you, Marty. This was so fun. I appreciate your inviting me.
Hey, you want to give out your phone number or a website or something?
Yeah, my website is just my name, www.karenfranklin.com, and from there you can get to my blog and other things.
Okay, perfect. Now you
thank
can duck out and go to your mom's event, or you can stick around for a while, whatever you like.
Okay, thank you, Marty. Okay. I appreciate it.
Take care. Okay, so now I asked Karen, there were a few things I was thinking of doing in my second segment. I gave her a choice. And she said the one that she would like is for me to do. I have this short, I like doing these audio essays for you. And this one is called The World's Shortest Course in Leadership. But I also want to prioritize you, my dear listeners. So if you are, or someone you care about, is struggling in your work life, even if you're ostensibly well-employed but still miserable, or you're unemployed, whether you're 16 or 76, whatever the nature of your problem, I can usually help you take at least a baby step, if not a giant step forward. I call them workovers, and this is the time to call when the lines are open. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now, While we're waiting for the calls to go. Oh, we've got the calls are coming in right away. So it, to prove that I'm walking the talk, I will delay my world, giving you my little audio essay on the world's shortest course in leadership, and I'll go right to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi there. Am I there?
You are here.
Hi, terrific. I had a question, and that was I have a close friend who's actually very, very interested in being a forensic psychologist.
Oh, she's still here. Karen, sit your butt down.
Oh, good. Oops.
Good. Ask her the question.
And okay, so I have a friend. He's very brilliant, and he actually grew up with a lot of abuse and stuff, so he's really particularly keen on, you know, people's behaviors and stuff from suffering a lot himself.
Mm-hmm.
He has, he's actually just finishing his bachelor's degree in psychology, so he doesn't, he's in his early 40s, so it's, you know, it's midlife here, but I'm just trying to gather information to help a little for him as far as what kind of avenues he might have once he completes his degree as far as getting more into a field like that. I know it's something with a lot of education usually, but
what are some of the best, what are the best training and practical routes to get into the right graduate school?
Right. And so I want to say first is I think it's great that he's a little bit older and has life experiences. I think that's super important in this field. But I will say it's a long row to hoe.
Uh-huh.
It's quite difficult. And so, I mean, I get so many calls from college students, high school students, even graduate students trying to get into this field because, you know, he should get a PhD degree or a PsyD degree, and that typically takes...
Which is better, PsyD, which is tends to be more practically oriented, PhD is more theoretical.
I think PhD is better.
Why?
Myself because there's more... stronger emphasis on research, which
right.
I think makes us better psychologists.
It makes sense. In your particular case, that's right, exactly, because you are analyzing research data. Okay, what else? Which PhD programs should be particularly considered? And because they're the best, they're probably hard to get into. So what kind of real-world experiences would elevate this person's chances of getting in?
What's his major?
You know, I'm not clear on that. I don't quite know.
Okay, and that it doesn't really matter, but I think probably if he can get some work experience in psychology, even volunteering, that might make mm-hmm. him a stronger candidate.
Like where? What kind of places would take a volunteer that would give him an opportunity that would look impressive to a graduate school in forensic psychology?
You know, there's lots and lots of things. There's children's hospitals, there's drug and alcohol treatment programs, all kinds of...
I see.
You know, public projects like that.
Which graduate programs really are the ones that tend to be real, not only door openers, because names like Stanford and Harvard, but they may not be as practical, where there's some places like John Jay, which I happen to know because I'm from back east, especially they're about training master's forensic psychologists.
Well, yeah, and I don't think a master's degree in forensic psychology.
No, I mean they're creating master,
okay,
meaning master,
okay.
Masters
yeah.
of their craft.
I wouldn't want to name a specific school, and I don't even think it's that important.
Okay.
You know, I know you, Marty, have been critical of colleges as hyping themselves, and I think the
yes.
same could be said of graduate schools.
Absolutely.
What I think it's more like what he puts into it and the types of internships that he gets. So I think you can go to a website. It's an American Psychological Association division of mm-hmm. forensic psychology. Mm-hmm. It's called Division 41, and they have a list, I believe, of all the different graduate programs. So, you know, just apply widely or in his uh-huh. geographic area, I think, would be fine.
For what I would add is, I'm trying to always put myself in the shoes of the employer. So what I would think that would, in this case, the employer, believe it or not, is the graduate school. He needs to, you know, if he had a 4.0 in psychology, you probably would have told me. I'm guessing he doesn't. So he needs to have some extraordinary work experience. So for me, I probably would try to apprentice with a forensic psychologist directly. I'd be willing to get his or her mail. I'd do whatever in exchange for listening, observing, asking questions. And that way, an eminent forensic psychologist would write a pretty amazing letter of recommendation. And the student's application essay would show an understanding of the nuance of forensic psychology that somebody who's simply working as a volunteer couldn't get.
Right. And let me add just two technical points on this, too. I think that's a good piece of advice. But in addition, forensic psychology is generally a postdoctoral specialization. Mm-hmm. So in other words, you would pursue a PhD or PsyD in clinical psychology. And then from there, you go on to do
a postdoc.
And not everybody's doing that. There are some graduate programs in forensic psychology, but that's rarer. And the other thing that is important, because I said just a second ago that what school didn't matter. But what is important is that it's accredited. You would not want to put, you know, spend a bunch of time and money going to a school that isn't accredited, because then you can't even get the internships and postdocs. You aren't eligible for them.
And as important is who your advisor is.
Because
if you get the right advisor, he or she won't shunt you into their little narrow research area, which ends up making you not hireable. You want to find somebody who's got a research area that is consistent with something practical and being a forensic psychologist, and more important, who has the temperament and time to be a mentor. Because in the end, real transformative behavior, transformation occurs one-on-one. And excellence is in the interstices, is in the spaces between. So learning subtleties, whether you're volunteering before getting to graduate school with a really excellent forensic psychologist, or you are that, or you're in the PhD program or the postdoc, as Karen correctly points out, being with a mentor who is somebody who is generous of time, spirit, and has that ineffable genius, if you will, to understand the gray areas and the subjectivities. Because right now, as Karen said a number of times during the interview, forensic psychology should be called forensic psychology, the art of forensic psychology, because it's as much art as science. Do you agree or disagree with that, Karen?
I totally agree. And that point you just made about mentorship, that is so critical. And it doesn't have to be a mentor within the institution that you know, the educational institution.
Good point.
My main mentor in graduate school actually was not at that school. I had to go outside and find him.
Good point.
Greg Herrick in Berkeley on the hate crime thing. He was so great, and he really helped my career along.
What did he do? What did Greg Herrick do for you? Tell me specifically. Give me one anecdote.
He sat down personally with me. We're still friends now. He sat down one-on-one with me and spent the time on an unofficial basis to help me conceptualize hate crimes and figure out how to do my research, and it was so helpful. And then I had another mentor as a postdoc, Greg Gagliardi, up at University of Washington, who was, again, just spent that, what you just said, one-on-one time, just had the energy to devote to teaching me how to write forensic reports. It was terrific.
I like to think that you, dear caller, now has gotten really quite a bit of good takeaways, that this person, if that person has that, what I call the real key ingredient, which is focus, drive. If that person, they don't have to be a genius, but if they have the focus, drive to do everything that Karen and I have said in this conversation, that person, I don't care if he's 50, that person will succeed. And if he doesn't or she doesn't have the drive, that's the party's over. Because drive and focus drive, not dabbling, is truly the under-discussed keys to success. Anyway, I thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemko.
Great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And Karen Franklin, thanks for staying. I know you got to run, so thank you very much for staying. It was invaluable that you were there for this call.
Yeah, that's a funny coincidence. Thanks again, Marty.
It wasn't a coincidence. You were just a guest.
I was just here. Yeah, that's right. I don't even know where I am.
Right. Okay, Karen, take care. Okay, now, phone number. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem, I can't guarantee we're going to be as helpful as we were to that previous caller. We were particularly good there. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now, as I promised a little earlier, a little audio essay called The World's Shortest Course in Leadership. I've read a lot about leadership, and I've been a career coach to many leaders and managers. And in respect for your time, here I've given myself the challenge of telling you the most valuable ideas I can within around 5 minutes. Number one, adapt the job to your strengths. Some managers and leaders are brilliant at hiring and planning and managing people and managing projects and inspiring. While it's true that most leaders have to do a combination of those, most leaders and managers usually have some power to adjust their job description, delegating away their weaknesses or simply not doing them. So you, what are your preferred activities, strengths, and weaknesses? Not sure? Is it time to get some anonymous feedback from your colleagues and supervisees? There's a great website called 15-5, the number 15 and the word 5, 15-5-E, which allows you to get anonymous feedback from people so you know what your strengths really are. Usually at this point, if you're over 20 or 30 or 40, you know, even if you suffer from the delusion of excessive high self-esteem, one of the afflictions of the Bay Area especially, you still have a pretty good sense of who you are. But if you'd like an additional perspective, that's a good one. The next key to in this world's shortest course in leadership is to hire wisely. You may be forced to keep some employees that you'd rather not, But where possible, replace employees who aren't A players, or at least B players, with stronger performers. You, your employees, and your customers will appreciate it, and you do have a high probability of finding at least B players if you take the time to search wisely. First of all, you need to know that for most positions, the specific expertise is not so critical. What really counts? Three things: intelligence, the aforementioned drive, and being low maintenance. That ends up being really key. Next, recruit by asking for referrals from your trusted colleagues. If you just rely on respondents to a job ad, it's dangerous. I've been coached to so many job seekers, and on average, it's the weaker applicants who do more to hide their weaknesses. They'll paper over their employment gaps and their poor performance on previous jobs. Many weak job seekers also do, I gotta tell you, some remarkably unethical things that I'm not going to mention here to avoid promulgating them. So if you're relying on your network, you are a far greater chance of getting somebody who really is good, not just somebody who appears good. Next, screen initial applicants with a short online or emailed quiz that taps candidates' ability to do a few of the job's common difficult tasks. And, you know, unfortunately, again, you have to worry about an applicant hiring some ringer to answer the questions. You need to let the candidates know that the candidates who end up getting interviewed are going to be taking a parallel quiz at the interview. But don't make it a big deal. Make it a 15-minute thing. Don't impose. I really feel in some ways, an employee advocate, that employers really take advantage of workers. They make them do all this stuff in advance, including long reports, and then they put them through 5 interviews. It's too much. You don't need to do that much. It's a sign of your insecurity that you can't make a decision based on a brief quiz and 1 or 2 thoughtful interviews, perhaps a group interview. Speaking of the interview should consist mainly of simulations. For example, if the person's going to be running meetings, you have him or her lead a few-minute meeting with the interviewers playing the role of the meeting attendees. Also, you've got to probe the applicant's claimed accomplishments. For example, tell me the details about how you saved the company $200,000. You want to avoid questions that can be coached in advance. Like, tell me about yourself. The quality of that person's answer could as likely be a function of how much practicing and coaching from a hired gun career counselor than, you know, anything that's revelatory about themselves. Avoid questions also like, tell me the greatest strength and weakness, or why the long employment gap. Those are very coachable questions. Before hiring, you do want to ask the top candidate, maybe two candidates, for not one reference, not two, not three, a half a dozen references, and here's why. And you want to ask, you want to get their phone numbers as well, these references. You want to call each of those references after hours, saying something like, I'm hiring for an important position that requires excellent intelligence, drive, and a low-maintenance personality. And maybe if there's some specific content expertise that you need, you can certainly include that. And you say, I'm considering Mary Jones for the position. If you think she's excellent on those dimensions, I'd really love a call. I like using the word love rather than greatly appreciate. There is that emotional content that I think creates more connection. So I'd really love a call. If not, there's no need to call back. Now, most people are very reluctant for legal or ethical reasons or just uncomfortability reasons to give a bad reference. But they are willing to not call back to get the point across that somebody may not be the greatest applicant. Of course, there are reasons other than disliking a candidate for not calling back. But unless you get at least 3 of 6 callbacks, beware of hiring that candidate. Next key in this world's shortest course in leadership: you need to inspire through a combination of vision, walking the talk, ongoing earned praise, and criticism with teeth. I'll break those down. Vision. We hear that word all the time, but you do need to make clear to your employees that even a mundane goal, as long as ethical, is worth striving for. For example, if I were the head of an accounts payable department, I would remind my employees, I do want you to know that getting the right amount of money without delay into people's hands ensures they can feed their families, and it ensures that businesses can pay their bills. That's important. We have an important mission, ladies and gentlemen. So presenting the vision, part of motivating is presenting a vision in an honest, really looking at that job in its fullest perspective. Another key to inspiration is to walk the talk. If you're lazy or unethical or otherwise a low standards boss, you cannot expect your employees to do better. There are very few lazy people who rise to leadership, but some weren't lazy, but they burn out. Realize if you're a manager or leader, if you start slacking, you definitely risk your employees doing the same, the opposite of inspiring them. Next, give only earned praise. In the old days, people praised too little, but now that the pendulum has swung very far, too many leaders today and managers today give praise too easily, so it becomes devalued or dishonest. It's not viewed as credible. Yes, there still are other managers and leaders who give too little praise because they're afraid of making the worker complacent or that it's going to result in a request for an excessive pay increase. So be liberal with earned praise, something that they really did well. And my favorite way to do that is not just verbally, but a handwritten note. Employees love taking handwritten notes home to show to their family. It's concrete. Words can go into the ether. Next, criticism in your workplace should not be viewed as a dirty word. Tactful criticism, at least sometimes it's appropriate, usually it's appropriate to be tactful, occasionally you need to be direct. But tactful criticism with suggestions for improvement should be an ongoing part of every manager and supervisee's relationship, that is, the relationship between a manager and the supervisee. Manage by walking around. Give feedback in context. That should be standard procedure. Next. I've said this many times before on the show, but it's so important. Hire slow, fire fast. Usually within weeks, if not days of hiring, it becomes clear whether an employee is likely to, without spending too much time coaching them, be at least a B player. If not, it is wise to counsel. Notice I didn't say fire. Try to counsel the person to find a better suited position. Doing that, counseling that person to help find a more suited position is better than starting the documentation for a termination procedure. It can be less painful for all concerned and more cosmically just, more ethical. Do hire slowly, cut losses quickly. And the final way of inspiring is don't rely on excessive pay or financial rewards to motivate. The fancy word is pecuniary. I like that word. Generally, as long as compensation is at least adequate, employees are motivated primarily by their job being ethical, not too demanding or too easy, and where they have earned praise where appropriate and gotten tactful feedback so they're growing. If employees are routinely demanding more pay and you think they're already reasonably paid, that can be a sign of problems within your work group. Investigate that rather than treating the symptom by giving a little raise. Next key in the world's shortest course in leadership, case by case, weigh the pros and cons of whether to make a decision on your own or to get input. We live in an era in which unilaterally made decisions are often viewed as too hierarchical. But I have seen many workplaces ground into torpor or into tepid decisions through the too frequent use of group input, let alone with decision-making by consensus. On a case-by-case basis, decide whether the speed and boldness of a unilateral decision outweigh the benefits of group input. Next, key to, in my world's shortest course in leadership, respect but suspect. Too often, one or more employees wants to sabotage you. That's just real. Maybe because he or she wants your job, or simply because he or she doesn't like you. Or personal jealousy, psychological problems, keep your antenna out. And to that end, try to surround yourself with people likely to be loyal to you, yet who are intelligent and secure enough to disagree with you and to tell you what's really going on with the troops. Next, be crisp. Of course, crisp leadership is useful beyond terminating a weak employee. For example, when you're trying to get group input, as soon as you feel at the time at a meeting would be better spent on something else, make the decision. Usually giving your reason, and then acknowledge others' input into it. But the good leader does not reflexively adhere to today's egalitarian ethos in which buy-in, input, consensus are extolled over bold decision-making. Rather, he or she evaluates when it's most time effective to unilaterally decide. Especially in fast-moving fields like high-tech and biotech, I have seen many businesses that unnecessarily dither go out of business. the next key in my world's shortest course in management, which has got about 1 minute left or two. Expert power can be more important than charisma. Expert power. So much of advice on leadership encourages charisma. But many fine leaders are introverted. For example, Charles Schwab is an introverted guy. Avon CEO Andrea Jung. Warren Buffett. They're all introverted. Their secret sauce? Expertise. That could be content expertise, like technical expertise, or it could simply be expertise in leadership. For example, excellence in leading an analysis of an organization's strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats, what they call SWOT. That said, storytelling, and more broadly, public speaking, matters in management leadership. Very important to develop that. I've written an article called Good Public Speaking Without Fear, and I've also written one on good storytelling. So if you could just Google Psychology Today and NEMCO and Good Public Speaking Without Fear, or NEMCO, Psychology Today, and storytelling, you'll get at least my best takes on that. Know how to inspire. Not surprisingly, prerequisite to inspiring is that a leader be an exemplar of what he or she wants others to do. And I said it earlier, hardworking, direct yet tactful, yet where possible. I want to skip ahead because of time and I want to take a quick call. Pivot promptly. When a project is flagging, the effective leader quickly assesses how to adjust, often gathering input from the troops. Then he or she inspires them to persevere by expressing fair-minded optimism that the revised plan will likely improve results and that the benefits to the workers, customers, and even society are worth the persistence. And finally, ethics is priority one. Management guru Warren Bennis describes managers as people who do things right, but leaders who do the right things. I have time for just the briefest of calls. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. Concisely state your question.
Is it me?
Yes.
Hi. Hi, Marty. Quick question. I was laid off in February, and it was a big layoff, I think up to 70 people.
Wow.
And I know that networking is key. I have a network, and I'm trying to get my LinkedIn up and running, but what's really blocking me is, you know, on LinkedIn, everybody has the current employer, and I have an end date for my last employer.
I'm not so worried about that. You just want to explain. The beautiful news you just told me is that you were part of a mass layoff. When you are the only one let go, it is much harder. But the first thing
you would know that, you know, by just
You can list that. You can say you can. There's no rigid rules. I would there and say, you know, to let's say the job ended last month. Currently, jobs when the listing on LinkedIn says to March 2017, I would write job terminated because of mass layoff 70 people, so that everybody sees it right there. I'd put that in your resume as well. And that is all the time I have, but I at least could give you that little nugget. Okay, great. That is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, as usual. And, of course, to all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers and a switch sides in the middle debate with the Napa County Superintendent of Schools and my wife, Dr. Barbara Nemco. The issue, is college still worth it? May 1st is the deadline for deciding. We're going to talk about it. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco, reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.